Okay, let's make a start. Welcome, everyone. My name is Kevin Featherstone, and I'm the director of the Hellenic Observatory. I'd like to welcome you all here, but also I know that there are a number of people watching online, and indeed I'm told they're watching online from many different countries, possibly as far away as Australia. So we have a lot of interest in tonight's event. Can I also say that tonight's event is being recorded, and we hope to make it available as a podcast for downloading later. So many people are watching live, more people will watch the podcast later. We're here looking back 50 years to the Athens Polytechnia uprising, when students confronted the junta. Let me say a few words by way of introduction. All nations create and sustain national stories, myths, if you like, that are shared and passed on. They bind nations together, creating a national identity. They're part of the answer to the question, when is a nation? Because a nation can only be said to exist when there is some sense of a shared history. Shared history have symbols, myths, pictures, events as their reference points. Such myths are not always interpreted in the same way, and differences can be crucial to the stories. The stories can divide, and they can change over time. Tonight, of course, we're reflecting on the student uprising within the Athens Polytechnic in November 1973. It is my earliest political memory of Greece. It forced its attention to students across the world. More importantly, within Greece, of course, over the last 50 years, this event has defined the political trajectory of a generation. It's prompted school closures and strikes as the memory has been kept alive. It's rallied protesters in annual parades across Greece, not least marches in Athens to the American embassy. But there are contrasts, of course, also. For many years, the Polytechnia uprising was canonized. But then, in the economic crisis more recently, its legacy has at times been savagely attacked. The Polytechnia mobilized a generation. Today, we talk of political apathy. The Polytechnia was about democracy, but it never was really linked to a specific political project. So we have contrasts. For the Polytechnia generation, the Polytechnia story became central to the sense of struggle, social change, and aspiration. At the time, in that period, it had no parallel in Spain or Portugal. There's no equivalent Polytechnia event in the collapse of authoritarian regimes in those two countries. So to what can we compare the Polytechnia events? May 1968 in Paris, the Prague Spring of 1968, Tiananmen Square in June 1989. What would be accurate and what would be overblown? Each of these events and histories, of course, are unique. How far the Polytechnia events actually contributed to the fall of the colonels is but one question. It clearly did prompt the shift from Papadopoulos to Ioannidis, marking the beginning of the end. Yet the events themselves have taken on wider meanings. They become part of a bigger whole. The Polytechnic was not actually the first protest under the junta. Students at the Athens Law School had protested against military conscription the previous February. But in a way, the Politecnia events were unique. It was the only major protest against a military dictatorship that lasted 7 years. The students, of course, borrowed their rallying cry from Solomos, Somi, Pedia, Eleftheria. But their appeal broadened, anti-imperialism, anti-NATO. And these appeals, these foci, structured Greek foreign policy for at least the next decade. Next year, Greece will reflect on 50 years of the Metropolitefsi, how their regime changed after 1974. But tonight, we're going to consider the meaning and the legacy of the Polytechnic uprising in the national story. And we have a great set of speakers to help us explore what happened and what was passed on. Zinovia Lialuti is Assistant Professor of Modern and Contemporary European History in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at the National and Kapodistrian University in Athens. She's published a number of books and articles on Greek politics, and she focuses on the formulation of national and political identities. She's focused in particular on the Politecnia events, to which obviously she will be speaking tonight. I must give the apologies of Professor Kalliopi Rigopoulou, who for personal reasons can't join us this evening, but I'll read a short note from her of recollections. She is now a professor emeritus at the University of Athens. And she says, like the overwhelming majority of those who took part in the Polytechnic uprising, she was not a member of any political party or organization. She remembers sitting behind the gates when a tank stormed in. The tank's turret would make a grinding sound as it turned and aimed at you. At that point, you say, either I'm going to run or I won't be afraid for a while. I think that's what happened to people who take part in such uprising. You're not afraid for a bit. Later, you might take fright at the sight of a mouse, but not at that precise time. Kalliopi Rigopoulou was wounded as police and army troops stormed the campus, arresting students. Yorgos Pavlakis, at the time, was a medical student who tended to Kalliopi Rigopoulou. George is a research biomedical scientist at the National Cancer Institute in the United States. He graduated from the Athens Medical School in 1976. He was freely elected as a representative of medical students during and after the dictatorship in Greece. He participated in the student movement and the revolts of November the 14th, 17th, 1973 at the Polytechnic. And he was a co-organizer of the medical facility of the student-occupied school that treated many victims. He was repeatedly arrested and mistreated by the police and was a fugitive after the revolt until the fall of the dictatorship. Nikos Christolakis is joining us online. Nikos is Professor Emeritus at the Athens University of Economics and Business, and even more importantly than that, he's a research associate at the Hellenic Observatory here at the LSE. During his studies at the National Technical University of Athens, he actively participated in the resistance movement against the military dictatorship. In the Polytechnic uprising in November 1973, he was in charge of the broadcasting station. After the fall of the dictatorship, he was chairman of the Students' Association from 74-75, and in 1976, he testified at the court-martial in Athens against the junta leaders. We have a marvelous panel, and I'm delighted that they've been able to join us either here or online. In order to get things started, in order to help us to focus on the events and then talk about the legacy, we'd like now to show a very short video of the events. So I'm going to read a statement, a recollection from Professor Kalliopi Rigopoulou. I'm then going to invite Zinovia to speak, and then Nikos Christoulakis, and then Yorgos Pavlakis. And then we'll have a discussion, and we'll open it to you, the audience. So this is a statement from Kalliopi Rigopoulou. Thank you for the invitation to talk about my personal experience of the November 1973 uprising. First of all, it's not easy to draw a clear line of demarcation between the personal and the collective. It's also not easy to isolate the Polytechnic experience either from the crucial Greek and international events that preceded or followed it, or from what was done and suffered by the crushing majority of the participants in the uprising, who were not in the precinct but around it, in the neighborhood, or even all around Athens and in other cities in Greece. I will try to isolate some comments, I will try to isolate some moments related to my experience as a participant witness of the events during the last night of the uprising, and also to the consequences of those events for me personally. The first of those moments occurred just a little before the tank broke through the gates and invaded the Polytechnic. As I stood behind the gates, I saw a student, later I learned that there were two, climbing the metal fence that separated us from the armed forces that encircled the school. He was holding a white flag, indeed it was his white shirt, and his aim, as he told me later, was to negotiate the peaceful departure of all of us from the buildings. Although I have no precise information on the matter, I guess he was representing the coordinating committee of the occupation. I nowadays believe that this effort, coordinated or improvised, was well intended, but of course it did not produce any positive results. Owing to the fact that those efforts for negotiations failed, the tank broke the gates I stood behind, opening the way to the armed invasion. It crashed two cars placed behind the gates with all the following consequences. Many aspects of the operation still remain obscure to me. What was the objective of the action? The identity of those that issued the order, the intentions and the feelings of each one of those involved in the army, who later, after I had recovered from the hospital, gave rather unconvincing interviews and expressed the wish to meet me, something which I always declined. The inclusion of the picture and the narrative of the invasion of the tank remains a must for old and recent TV documentaries, and a raw material for political rhetorics expressing various ideologies and objectives. The third point I would like to stress is the first medical care I received at the Polytechnic Infirmary and at the hospitals where I was a few hours later, transferred by people risking their lives to do so. I believe that those people performed miracles of capacity and courage. Besides my mother, who immediately became my guardian angel, and other people, nursing staff, injured other persons, and their friends and relatives, they stood by me. One night, some of these people transported me to another floor of the hospital so that I could meet Spiros Moustaklis. He was the army officer, the protagonist of a patriotic 1973 movement to overthrow the junta, who, after the failure of this attempt, he became mute and almost paralyzed because of the monstrous tortures to which he was submitted. He, however, found the force to embrace me. Later on, after the reestablishment of democracy, I, thanks to the Greek Social Security Foundation, traveled twice to London to be examined by specialists for the treatment of bone fractures and to undergo 14 separate operations. It was then that Marion Sarafis, eminent Anglo-American archaeologist and historian, widow of the general in command of the ELAS forces against the German occupation of World War II, gave me the following advice. We women suffer because we are valued on the basis of our family and social status or of the traumas that we have suffered. I urge you instead to try to obtain recognition because of what you do, what you did, and what you create. As a result of the 14 operations and of my firm decision to follow her advice, I recovered the possibility to walk and, when necessary, to run. Something which, among others, enabled me to take part in the demonstration of 1982 on the occupied soil of Cyprus, protesting against the Turkish invasion. And much more recently, after 2010, to take part in Athens against the predatory memoranda imposed upon the Greek people. Calliope Rikopoulou's recollections. As I say, we're going to have the recollections from Nikos Christolakis and Yorgos Pavlakis in a moment, but for an overview of the meaning, the significance, the legacy of the Polytechnia, Genevieve.
Thank you very much. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, let me say how extremely honored I am to be here on this very important occasion. I'm going to try to comment on three things. Polytechnia as a part of Greek political and social history, Polytechnia from the perspective of Greek-American relations, and finally some comments on Polytechnia in Greek public history. Even though it did not bring about the immediate collapse of the military regime, the uprising and its suppression was a milestone in the history of the Greek dictatorial regime in two major aspects. The first being the internal disruption of the regime, and the second being the attitude of Greek society towards the dictatorship. The uprising was a catalyst in bringing to the fore pre-existing tensions among the dictators and precipitating the overthrow of Papadopoulos by Ioannidis. The latter put an end to his predecessor's experiment in limited liberalization and implemented an authoritarian turn during the final phase of the dictatorship. In terms of the second aspect, the suppression of the uprising was decisive in eroding tolerance and somewhat passive acceptance of the regime by Greek society. The brutality of the regime's response to the student uprising brought the end to whatever existing illusions on the dictatorship's character and prospect for self-reform. Moreover, the uprising is a crucial link in the Greek long 60s, which eventually came to an end only in 1974, and in the youth and protest movements of the period. The Greek long 60s involve a protest cycle that revolves around major political developments, such as the contested elections of 1961, the 1965 political crisis that was triggered by the overthrow of the George Papandreou government, as well as by developments on the Cyprus issue also in the mid-60s. In particular, the contestation of the electoral outcome of 1961 gradually evolved into political mobilization that allowed for the convergence between the center and the left in the shaping of social protest. This convergence often transcended the intentions or desires of the political leaderships of the center and the left and was built on the motivation of their respective electoral audiences. It was centered on the challenging of the post-civil war political setting, which had institutionalized anti-communism. This trend was further strengthened during the 1965 protest cycle. It is worth stressing that despite the limitations in the expression of political protest, the July 1965 crisis resulted in an unprecedented wave of political protest. More than 400 mass gatherings in public space were organized in 70 days. The mid-60s and its aftermath were, in essence, the manifestation of the impasse of the post-civil war political order and of the imbalance between the political and the social structure. As far as the youth component of the anti-dictatorial movement is concerned, two distinct generational groups can be distinguished. The first had experience in the protest movement of the early and mid-60s, which had centered on demands for political and social democratization, while the second group had no previous experience in protest movements and had formulated its collective identity during the dictatorship. The radicalization of the second group is revealing for the ideological transformation of the Greek middle-class youth as a result of the experience of the military dictatorship. Nevertheless, it should be stressed that the process of identity formation was not defined exclusively by national events and currents. The identity formation of the Greek youth during the long 60s was also shaped by transnational ideological and cultural trends, such as anti-imperialist sentiments, integration into mass consumption patterns, and participation in a cultural universe involving distinct musical, literary, and film products. Despite differences in the Greek political and social context, the Greek youth was, in many respects, like its Western counterparts, also between Marx and Coca-Cola. Moreover, the Greek anti-dictatorial movement had a solid anti-American discourse that allowed for the common framing of the national and the international setting, merging the experience of dictatorial Greece with the experiences of the European and the global South, as well as with the American social movements. For instance, in 1970, Greek students held as political prisoners expressed their solidarity with the American youth, protesting against U.S. intervention in Cambodia, framing American economic, political, and military elites as those who bomb civilians in Vietnam, who murder women and children in cold blood, who support tyrants in Greece and Latin America, and are now ready to turn Southeast Asia into a bloody chessboard. Greek-American relations during the military dictatorship and their aftermath have been widely debated, but it is worth further exploring the youth anti-dictatorial movement under the prism of U.S. diplomacy. The Polytechnic School uprising is particularly revealing for the gap between the interpretive repertoires of the Greek youth and those of U.S. diplomacy. Since the early 60s, American cultural diplomacy had defined Greek students as a group of particular importance, a group of potential leaders in the realm of politics, science, etc., and had tried to create ties to that particular group through various means. The main idea behind this American project was that Greek youth could and should identify its visions and aspirations for social and cultural modernization with the American model. In this line of reasoning, political anti-Americanism in Greece was often underestimated or misinterpreted, because American cultural diplomacy strongly felt that the vision of modernization, mainly associated with the U.S. pattern, would overshadow all other agendas. The modernization thesis, sustained by public opinion research in Greece, conducted under the auspices of the United States Information Agency, were the underlying assumptions of this argument. Based on quantitative data drawn from other biased opinion surveys in pre-dictatorial and dictatorial Greece, American diplomacy was confident that Greek youth interpreted the demand for change mainly as economic growth and rise of living standards. For instance, according to opinion surveys that U.S. officials requested in 1970, 60% of Greeks believed that their country was moving to the right direction and believed that their future would be one of material prosperity. Under this prism, the rise of the student anti-dictatorial movement was interpreted by American diplomacy as a revolution of rising expectations, failing to grasp with its political and anti-American content. A look at the report submitted by the United States Information Service in Athens on July 1973 is revealing for American perception at the time. Quote, any statement by high-ranking U.S. officials to the effect that Greece is a valuable piece of strategic territory and that the West therefore must continue to do business with the regime was invariably exploited by the press to depict the United States as a nation that has sold its democratic principles for the price of a naval base. What was then to be done? According to the report, the goal was to persuade a large number of present and potential Greek leaders, particularly the younger elements, that American society is continually evolving and that American cultural and intellectual life is suffused with vitality and the spirit of exploration. Young Greeks, like young people throughout the world, respond enthusiastically to innovation and novelty. Our efforts in this direction have taken the form of youth-oriented programs. Personal contact with youth continues to be extremely difficult. Greek students and other younger people are disinclined to associate with Americans or to patronize American programs because of our political identification with the present Greek government. What could then be done? U.S. officials suggested that the goal was to persuade present and potential leaders that American institutions and developments in the political, social, economic, and educational spheres are highly advanced and their achievements are applicable to the Greek process of modernization. Making inroads into the non-political aspects of this area is not difficult. This is largely because of the existing hunger for knowledge. Thus, since 1974, American public diplomacy was faced with a paradox. The influence of American culture, economy, science was evident in post-authoritarian Greek society. Nevertheless, this did not prevent the rise of a middle-class anti-Americanism. Apart from the mass demonstrations, which certainly attract more attention, the symbolic gesture of scientists returning their PhD diplomas from American universities to the US Embassy in Athens is also worth noticing. It was the symbolic proof that middle-class modernity could be compatible with anti-Americanism. The Polytechnic School uprising is an integral part of the national myths of the Third Hellenic Republic. Regime change, after all, after the fall of dictatorship, necessitated a reinterpretation of the national past and national identity. A basic aspect of this process was the question of guilt or innocence of the Greek nation for the establishment of the military junta and for the Cyprus tragedy as well. Anti-Americanism had emerged as a powerful interpretive scheme, not only with reference to the military dictatorship, but also with reference to the entire post-war period and what has been called sickly democracy. An underlying metaphor in this anti-American discourse that sought to interpret Greece's post-war history was the metaphor of occupation. Occupation provided a link of continuity between Nazi occupation and US influence on post-Civil War Greece, which was perceived as a status of limited sovereignty. In this context, the Polytechnia was framed as a link in the chain of resistance episodes that made the history of the Greek people since the War of Independence. The first parliamentary elections of the post-authoritarian period were held on November 17, 1974, on the decision of Konstantinos Karamalis. Andreas Papandreou at the time claimed that this decision disrespected the memory of the victims, while Karamalis argued that the coincidence between the anniversary and the elections was the best commemoration service for those fallen in 1973. A week after the election, in the context of public commemoration, a march to the US Embassy took place, setting the pattern for the ritual of the commemoration in the following years. Participants in that first march were estimated to 1 million people. The site of the US Embassy in Athens was designated as the destination of the march, which was both a commemorative and a protest event. This choice, followed by anti-American slogans such as "Out with the Americans, murderers of the peoples" that dominated the march, mirrored the blame attribution process in Greek society since 1974. The commemoration of the Polytechnia can be seen in the context of public history as a means for institutionalizing the memory of sickly democracy, the memory of the dictatorship, and of their anti-American implications. This is not to say, of course, that the perception of the meaning of the uprising was homogeneous. Nevertheless, the Greek left and center-left converged in the framing of Polytechnia as a national symbol and as the legitimizing narrative of the Third Hellenic Republic. The speech delivered by the rector of the Polytechnic School in the mid-80s on the occasion of the construction of a commemorative monument for the school students that lost their lives in World War II is revealing in this respect. According to the rector, by attributing to the uprising of the Polytechnic School the historical gravity of the national resistance movement, we restore the unity, the continuity, and the consistency of the relentless struggles of the youth and of the Greek people throughout the entire historical period stretching from 1941 to 1974. Following the rise of PASOK to power in 1981, the commemoration of the uprising gained further prominence in the public agenda, in the interaction between public history and political communication. PASOK sought to sustain the historical continuity between the post-war center, the anti-dictatorial student movement, and the party of PASOK as a representative of the center-left. Andreas Papandreou became the first prime minister to lay a wreath on the site of the Polytechnic School, and since that year, 1981, the anniversary became a school holiday. During the economic crisis, the uprising and its anniversary was repoliticized, falling the cleavage between memorandum versus anti-memorandum parties. The center emphasized the national character of the anniversary, downplaying the external element dimension. Within the anti-memorandum camp, however, the uprising emerged as a present of resistance against the limitations of democracy set by the austerity politics. "The junta did not end in 1973" was the slogan that captured this mood. On the far right end of the political spectrum, the memory of Polytechnia is contested. The discourse of the extreme right challenges the historical facts by denying the killing of civilians during the junta suppression of the uprising and insists that this was a bloodless episode. Moreover, throughout the 50 years of post-dictatorial Greece, the phrase "the Polytechnic School generation" has evolved into a contested and controversial concept, with its meaning constantly changing. What does the phrase "the Polytechnic School generation" mean after all? It is used as a metonym for parliamentary democracy itself, a mirror projecting its virtues and flaws. Last Sunday, newspaper Το Βήμα published an opinion poll trying to capture perceptions of the uprising in Greek society today. 81% of respondents believe that the uprising contributed to the overthrow of the dictatorship, and 76% felt that the uprising expressed mass reaction against the regime rather than being a limited phenomenon. As far as the commemoration was concerned, 86% said that the anniversary should be acknowledged with laying wreaths at the Polytechnic School. 79% said that it should involve commemorative activities at schools, and 51% said that it should include the march towards the US Embassy. Finally, as I was leaving the law school building yesterday, the uprising was well alive in the students' memory practices and closely linked to their interpretive schemes of the international, geopolitical, and the national political setting. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. That gives us a very nice context. I'm hoping we can now invite Nikos Christodoulakis to speak to us. Can you hear us, Nico? I think you're on mute at the moment.
Thank you very much to everybody. First of all, let me thank the LSE and the Hellenic Observatory for giving me this opportunity to be with you and talk about the anniversary of 50 years of the Polytechnic uprising. I feel very honored about that, and I think it's time for the uprising to be discussed outside Greece as well as a major political event which actually has transformed not only Greek politics but also Greek perceptions about the role of students and about the concept of liberty and independence. This is perhaps the reason behind the appearance of the Polytechnic uprising as number one event in the last 50 years, as has been presented by the Guardian newspaper a couple of months ago. Also, that was a great recognition of the importance of this uprising. Many things have been said about how the uprising took place and how it shaped political events later on. So in my speech, rather than repeating these issues, I would like to draw your attention to four major issues, four questions, which always come about whenever we talk about Polytechnic uprising, either in Greece or abroad. The first and major question is whether the uprising was organized or spontaneous? Was it planned or certain? My answer to that is that it was a mix of those, a mix of everything. Because it's very important to understand that the atmosphere, the political atmosphere, for quite a few months before the uprising took place, was very revolutionary in a sense. It was very fluid in political terms and very promising and full of opportunities in writing actions against the regime. I think that major events have started since that February 1973, after the occupation of the law school and also the conscription of about 100 students who were taken out of the schools and were sent to the army in order to try to restrain and threat the student movement. But of course, the movement continued and a lot of activities were taking place all the way through. Another major event was the revolt in the Navy, which actually shook the inside of the junta and left a lot of questions about its stability and consolidation. But I think that the major event which took place before the uprising was the memorial ceremony which took place in the beginning of November with respect to George Papandreou, a very popular centrist politician. During that memorial service, the crowd of students and other people actually was clashed with the police. And that was the first case when police actually were running because they were completely unable to control the crowd at the demonstration which erupted after the memorial service. And I think that this, in a way, gave us a signal that the junta is not invisible. And if we coordinate our forces strengthen our strategy, everything is possible. So just 1 week after this demonstration, there have been a massive student assemblies taking place, both in the Polytechnic campus and elsewhere in Athens. So there was a couple of days during which everybody was in a sort of fervent that something is just about to happen. Of course, I have to say here that there has been no typical formal decision about to implement an expansion in Polytechnic campus, but this somehow happened after a few hundred students had arrived demonstrating through Athens while student assemblies were taking place. So in Wednesday night, we see that a lot of people participate also from the outside, and we get the feeling that something much more massive is possible to take place. And I think at that moment we realize that we are not just a student protest, but we may be in a position to transform it to a popular uprising. So we get organized during that night, of course with several logistical problems, some clashes between us, sometimes violence, but at the dawn of the next day, Thursday, I think we're in a position to control the campus and also to invite many more students to arrive here and take part with us in the uprising. And at the same time, huge crowds actually gather outside the campus and form a massive popular demonstration against each other. This is very important to understand because this is precisely what made this uprising unique and determined its character in the next couple of days. Now I come to the second issue, which is the contents, the character, the targets of the uprising. Well, I think above all it was against the junta. The main demand of students and the people alike was down with junta. But of course it was strongly anti-American because everybody was credited in the United States as being responsible for both staging and keeping in office the junta. And also because during the last couple of months before the uprising, the US Navy had increased massively its presence in Greece, and you could see a lot of American sailors and officers working in Athens and greatly offending the national feeling of Greek citizens. And then, of course, it was anti-NATO as well, because NATO was also endorsing junta, and from time to time, it was actually so much gratifying it that was also very offensive. But apart from the political side, there was also an economic side of demands and protestations. For example, I remember that there were quite a few demands for wage rise because living standards have severely deteriorated at that time. And also there have been some protesters who have gathered in the campus in order to fight against the land appropriation that was taking place in Megara in order to build a huge refinery. And this has given rise to some economic demands as well, especially against foreign capital invading the country and expropriating national wealth. So I think the content of the uprising was not just against dictatorship, but it was reflecting a wider set of demands and of beliefs, which also shaped its impact in after the fall of Jordan. Another issue which I would like to draw to your attention is the role of the political forces vis-à-vis the political neo-uprising. In a single word, I can describe this behavior as completely disappointing. Most of the political parties either abstained from saying something about the uprising or outright condemned it. Even the left-wing parties, especially the Communist Party, actually both Communist parties, have strongly condemned the event because perhaps they thought that it was provoking something against them, or because they were believing that the super liberalization that the process was advancing at the time would open up some opportunities, more opportunities for them to increase their influence in the masses. But also from top politicians, there was complete silence. So the uprising was left actually without any mainstream political support. Of course, afterwards, that was a benefit. That was an advantage of the uprising because it was proven to the public opinion that it was clear of political manipulation and any party manipulation at all. Finally, I would like to say a few things about the perennial question if the Polytechnic uprising was the key factor which overthrew the Jordan regime, or was it responsible for the Cyprus coup d'etat, which took place 8 months later and brought about the fall of the dictatorship. Well, in my opinion, the coup d'etat which followed the Polytechnic uprising by some even more cruel military forces in Greece by the Ioannidis group was actually not precipitated by the uprising itself, but it was planned long ago, possibly because they had some patricidal differences, or because the Ioannidis group was strongly opposing the pseudo-liberalization process that Papadopoulos had started a few months ago. So in any case, that coup d'etat was actually planned and was not the result of the uprising. In any case, nobody can plan a coup d'etat just in a week's time. The other issue about the treason in Cyprus and the coup d'etat which followed later on there, I have to say that Jonda, from the first moment when it was installed in 1967, it has made a critical target to overthrow the Makarios regime in Cyprus, to actually hard its independence and to create a situation which was much weaker in defending the integrity and independence of the island. I can say several things about that, from withdrawing Greek forces from the island, from organizing some very provocative events and in fact inviting Turks to intervene in Cyprus in several episodes, and finally actually by shelling off Cyprus and in the July coup d'etat. Of course, after the Cyprus coup d'etat, Jordan could not survive any more day, But in any case, I think the Politecnia uprising was the key factor which delegitimized any sense of tolerance vis-à-vis the regime. It was impossible for Junta to remain any more months, perhaps even a year or something. But in any case, it was bound for the dictatorship to end after the uprising. Why? Because of so many killings, of so many inhuman killings of young people who were defenseless against the armored tanks of the Junta. Just remember that not even during the Nazi occupation of Greece was even used armored vehicles against unarmed people. And I think that this showed the cruelty of the regime and the unbearability in political terms. So I think, in a way, Politecnia uprising actually signed the end of Junta one way or another. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nico. Thank you, Nico, and we're delighted you've been able to contribute to the discussion, and we'll give you the opportunity of responding to the discussion later. Yorgo.
Thank you. And am I on?
Or? Yes, you can.
Okay. Thank you for the invitation. Great event, and I'll try to not overlap very much with the previous one speakers, but 50 years after Politecnio, this Athenian popular revolt against the military dictatorship, this is recognized as a significant political event in European history, and for some aspects unique, in my opinion. And I must say that the commemoration of the uprising in Greece every year is not a typical public distant memory, but an event that still mobilizes Greek society one way or another. The top event is, of course, the demonstration every year from the Polytechnic School to the American Embassy. And many call it a commemoration. Others consider it a divisive effect. It does create tension, which is a sign of an active political process rather than a dry festivity of the past. The side that wants to forget or minimize the importance of Politecnio suppresses any evidence of police and army wrongdoing and brutality, and tries to discredit the numbers, the importance, and the legacy of the event. I am here not as a political analyst, of course, but to provide some of our experiences of this period. And first, I would like to focus briefly why Politecnio happened that particular time. That was because during that time, the organization of the university students, which were against suppression by the military junta, that covered all aspects of free expression and association, had advanced. The organization had advanced. We were a new generation that did not carry the scars in the experiences, the bad experiences of the brutal Greek civil war, a really brutal war that was the first armed confrontation of East and West while there was still the Second World War going. And of course, the British and then the Americans won in Greece unequivocally. Later on, of course, in Korea, the country was divided and remains so, and finally in Vietnam there was a different outcome. The point that I want to make about the student movement is that we were young, did not have the previous experiences of the older decimated generations in Greece. We had created an organization and trust among us through the bonds that we developed at that time. And that provided a minimal structure to give voice to the widespread disagreement with the suppressive junta at that time. And of course, during the fall of 1973, as you heard before, the dictatorship made an effort for a transition to a kind of normalization, which is a strategy similar to that applied later in Chile by Pinochet, that kept him in power for a long, long period of time. We, as the student movement at that time, more and more sure of ourselves, did not agree with that and wanted the dictatorship to end then and there. That was our collective feeling and decision. And this boiling pot of that time, and Nikos mentioned a key event, November 4th, a demonstration against the police and the junta, that of course preceded Polytechnic School. This boiling pot exploded with the occupation of the Polytechnic School in the middle of Athens. We occupied the school and determined to fight the junta to oppose the very existence of it. And the exciting thing that happened at that time was that the population of Athens joined gradually the protest by coming in greater and greater numbers in successive days and getting into or around the Polytechnic School, joining demonstration and threatening the very existence of the military regime. This converted the event from a student protest to a popular revolt, not only in Athens, but also it started in several other cities in Greece, especially the cities that they had universities and student bodies, and especially in Thessaloniki, Patra, and Giannina. That's something that we should not forget. And that's something that showed that the entire Greek population in their majority was against the junta and ready to demonstrate for that. Now, it is difficult for us to describe and give a feeling of the exhilaration and the uplifting of these hours that we were together, and also the discipline, the inventiveness, the self-organizing, the self-organization that we managed to put together, and that was driving us to find solutions, and some solutions were appearing from rapidly, like magic. People ask me, how did we manage to equip a medical facility in hours? And the most likely explanation is by magic and by the coordinate movement and discipline of many, many young and old people, that they were bringing drugs, they were bringing equipment, anything you can imagine. But here I also want to underscore the second necessary ingredient for this development, other than the enthusiasm, the radio station, the radio of the Free Greek Students, which made a tremendous difference because it provided information and communications and inspired many people to join. And of course, Nikos, who I'm glad to be here with, had a major contribution. The radio station started very humbly. The first day we were trying to find a way to put it together. And that was another example of self-organization together with the food distribution, of course, and sanitation, and other form of communications like writing and distributing tricks all over. Hundreds and hundreds of young kids were writing and reproducing as best as they can tricks. Painting buses that went all over the Athens area. But soon it was the station that carried the day. It was covering more and more of Athens at the end, the whole Athens region. It was supported by several or many illegal radio stations that were set up by amateurs at that time. That was not allowed by the junta, but also by even by telephone. And it went throughout the world, as we know, as far as Australia, to Greeks, mainly Greeks all over the world. And this made the difference, in my opinion. In fact, in record time, I believe that we had created a primordial internet before internet, to spread our message against the totally controlled media of the dictatorship. And of course, as I mentioned, Nikos had his role in that. I was fortunate to go around during the revolt in different positions and observe many aspects, including the radio station and also the medical facility. I was especially charged, I must say, I took part as a group of people, and my task was to organize the medical services together with other medical students. And from the first day, of course, we had some wounded people from fights with stones and other items. And it was necessary, obviously, with more than 1,000 people in the area, in the occupied school, that later became several thousand, to organize medical care. But really nothing prepared us to predict the brutality of the police and the army that Friday night, that they started to shoot to kill. And as Nikos mentioned, that hardly happened anywhere in Europe. Even in during German occupation, we do not have examples of armored vehicles and tanks shooting to kill with huge guns.
In Greece.
In the middle of Athens, in Greece, yes. Yeah, of course, there are other places that this happened, but that doesn't make it less problematic and painful. One of the last severely wounded persons we took care in the makeshift medical facility was Pepi Rigopoulou. You heard her statement. She suffered for a long time. I thought that she was probably dead. She was very severely wounded. Her legs were in very bad shape. And during my long times underground, after the Polytechnic events, that was a heavy load on my psyche. Ending, I want to say that unfortunately, the English literature in the subject of the Polytechnic uprising and what exactly happened, especially the underscoring of police and army brutality, is very poor, the English literature. But even the Greek studies were lagging, and I think it's very fortunate that several new Greek publications, and I have some of them that came out days ago that I read again by friends, that they describe much, much better what happened and agree, I believe, with the picture that we try to paint here. We know of 24 officially dead, but it's commonly accepted that there are several and many more. And actually, it's very fortunate and pure luck, I think, that the number of dead is not much, much higher because of the kind of the wounds that they happen. We know of more than 1,300 wounded, many by military guns. The majority are not students. Actually, a recent study says that probably 60% approximately, they were not students. They were workers and clerks and housewives and even kids that went out to the balcony and got shot. So just a couple of words for the aftermath. I think that the events during the Athenian Revolt became part of the founding myth of the new Greek Republic, now 49 years old. And it has, of course, a very long period of peace and relative prosperity despite the multiple problems. So overall, a good development. But after the fall of the Junta, Politecnio functioned as a cathartic ritual where everybody participated, at least in their mind, some fighting the police and the army in the streets, but most of the millions of the Greeks participated, at least emotionally, and the radio station is a big, big part of this. But even this emotional participation just made the Junta not tolerable anymore. That was the beginning of the end, and you heard Nikos, I'm not going to repeat. I agree with everything he said. Junta finished with the tragedy of Cyprus that is still to be arranged, completed, finalized. I don't know how. But the change of the government removed the army from power, but the overall system remained pretty much the same at the beginning. Most Junta supporters were protected initially or avoided prosecution, and many kept their positions. So the lack of this completion of a true rapid democratic transition that happened much longer, much later, this lack of catharsis haunted the Greek political system for a while. And the Polytechnic experience still colors some aspects of life in Greece, I believe, especially the situation at the universities that feel the legacy of these events much more intensely. I believe, though, that this 50-year mark is probably a turning point. New generations are coming along that have not a real association with these events. The Greece of that time does not exist anymore. And I hope that the Greeks find a way finally to move on from the traumas and the divisiveness of the past.
Thank you, George. Thanks, George, very much indeed. I know we're tight for time. I'm going to ask a few questions which our speakers may wish to take up. Please try to keep your answers short. I'm then going to open it to the audience here, the audience online. I can see questions coming in on the laptop, and I will do my best to have a good range of questions. So let's begin the questions, but please, short answers. And with your permission, we may go beyond the designated time of 8 o'clock. A quick question, please, to both to George and Nikos. I wonder at the time, after the 17th, after the quashing of the uprising. In those weeks and months, over the next 7 or 8 months, what your feelings were looking back at the Politecnico? It's been a defeat. It had been something with hope. You couldn't possibly have predicted how the junta would collapse or when it would collapse. Was the immediate response of failure or of what, George? Just briefly.
Oh, those were among the most depressive times in my life, at least, because, well, after the exhilaration and the high that we had at that time, here we are defeated and haunted. I was banned from the medical school and was hiding until Cyprus. And of course, there was no way to say what's going to happen. The examples that we had were not very encouraging. I was thinking that we're going to be the next lost generation. And you know, towards the summer, I was thinking that my career and life in Greece is over. I was thinking about getting an illegal passport and trying to leave. Very depressing times indeed. But as you said, there was no way to predict that. And if it was not for Cyprus, I think that the junta maybe, I mean, it was inevitable that it's gonna end because it lost public support, unlike other dictatorships in other places. The Greek population was totally against, but no prediction on when it's going to end.
Thanks. Nico, your immediate response, hope, failure, what?
A short reply. I think most of us were hiding for 5 months after the uprising in order to avoid arrest. But still we kept on meeting between us. And in every meeting, especially after a couple of months after the uprising, we were thinking of how to repeat some drastic action in order to bring down Junta. So the uprising, of course, has caused some sad feelings because a lot of people were killed and a lot of others were arrested and tortured. But nevertheless, I think we also got the feeling that dictatorship is not invisible. That was the key which was guiding us in order to organize the next step. And I think that the next step would sooner or later would come up if the tragedy of Cyprus had not occurred. So I think that in the new academic year, 1974, I think that something more organized and better planned would have taken place against Junta.
Okay.
Thank you. One thing I would like to ask. I see a lot of questions which are written up in the Q&A.
Yeah, we'll come to that. We'll
these questions as well now.
We'll come to those, Nico. Thank you. The other thing I wanted to ask was that this was all events are unique, but this is a very peculiar event. As you've said, there was little party support, no organized political party, mainstream party supported the event. It's an exceptional form of political mobilization, students, workers on the outside. It created a phenomenon, but a phenomenon which was less than coherent. It didn't have a political project or agenda, defined agenda, behind it. When we think of that political mobilization of the Politecnico, I wonder in the subsequent years, when we talk about the 70s and 80s, was the fact of that political mobilization, you think, a healthy legacy for the system? Or did it, or was the legacy of something which was rebellious but unfocused? George.
Well, big question. How can I go for a short answer? I think that the majority of the people during this polytechnic school revolt, they were not organized formally in political parties, but they had their, this situation was changing every day, every week, every month, because and that was one thing that was behind the thinking of the left parties at that time, a little bit more freedom during the Marquezini's liberalization that Papadopoulos allowed, that would allow better organization. That was the thinking.
My point was different, though. A long-term legacy, I don't know whether Zinobia wished to comment on it, it leaves in the system, in the national story, a sense of protest, but not a political project, mm-hmm. not a political program. It defines a generation, but it lacks some coherence.
Well, this is...
And for a system, is this healthy or not healthy?
I want to stress out, I open a can of worms, but armatoli ke kleftes is not a new thing in the Greek system. So what I mean, bandits that became freedom fighters
is a
long line in Greece, and they're always popular.
Yes. Indeed, but you might say in the 19th century it had difficult consequences. Zinobia.
My comment would be that, although there are many ambiguities, of course, but the legacy, I guess, from the perspective of the system, as you described it, is rather positive, because the absence of a concrete political agenda means that it can be adapted to several political agendas. And also, let's not forget that the main legacy of the event in the long-term public history is that it provides a conciliatory version of national identity. So in the 70s, in the 80s, when you have to look at your recent historical past and ask who is to blame for the dictatorship, for what happened in Cyprus, you have the Politecnio myth and says, here we have a mass revolt and we all stood for it, we all supported it, we all hugged the Politecnio movement, despite of the historical fact there. And it provides a sense of inclusiveness in the perception of what the nation did or did not do in the previous year. So it offers a very valuable myth that the nation is innocent, after all.
Yeah, okay. A final point from me at this stage. To use the cliche, history isn't about the past, it's about the present. We reinvent, we construct the events from the past in different ways. And Zinobia, in your presentation, you highlighted in the context of the economic crisis much more recently, the phrase, the dictatorship didn't end in 1973. So the cleavage, the division of the Politecnio became overlaid with pro or anti memorandum in the context of the economic crisis. What do you think was consistent or not consistent in that kind of equation? They're creating quite a difficult link between the two events. What do you think is valid, invalid?
Well, we can never say you know, the characterization valid or invalid is not helpful. I mean, people in different time periods choose the way they frame the past, the way that they select versions of the past to interpret what is happening to them in present time. So yes, it is an overextension of the concept of the dictatorship that I realize that this may sound insulting or excessive to many people to equate the dictatorship with the experience of an economic crisis. But our work, I mean, is to try to understand this, to try to understand why people, many, many years later, choose a particular framing. They choose to equate the consequences of an economic crisis with a status of dictatorship. It is too much, yes, but it is a political reality, and we need to look into it and understand the mechanism. So it's about historical analogies. People use historical analogies all the time.
And it is a kind of story of half of Greece, isn't it? That's the other half probably isn't in this room. The other half isn't watching online. It's a national story, which is a division. People are not necessarily engaging with it. Okay, let me remind the online audience that you can send questions using the Q&A facility at the bottom of your screen. And I'm going to open it up to questions here in the audience. If you could try to keep them brief and just identify who you are, and we'll take as many as we can. Bernard, we need the microphone in front of you.
Thank you all for an interesting evening. I want to bring up the tragedy of Cyprus because I was interested in how did views of the participants of the Polytechnic respond following the invasion of Cyprus. And I got the impression that everybody then sort of suddenly solidarized again, but possibly solidarized, okay, with the rejection of a Turkish invasion, but it was an invasion which they had caused. That's the tragedy of Cyprus. And could you comment upon that, please?
Any historians?
It was argued earlier. I mean, there was a persistent and coherent strategy of the dictatorial regime against the Makarios leadership in Cyprus. So it would have happened anyway, regardless of the Polytechnic uprising. So I cannot say whether the participants in the uprising felt at some point that they were to blame. I hope not, because that was not their fault. I mean, the entire military regime, but especially the Ioannidis group, had a fierce and completely blind attitude towards Makarios. He had conspired for many, many months against the Makarios leadership. He would have done it anyway.
Well, there are divisions in Greece. A big conclusion, but the people that are against the Polytechnic School uprising, they don't like the music, they don't like the noise, they don't like the dresses, they don't like the demonstrations, they don't. They are ready to criticize everything. And they blame the Polytechnic School uprising for everything. Nikos addressed that, I think, in a very good way. The military junta from the beginning had a very, very long-term organized plan for Cyprus, and they finally carried it out to the worst outcome possible. And we suffer the Cyprus. Cypriots suffer still now 49 years later. So that was a plan, and we cannot ignore this reality. To blame Polytechnic School, to blame the people that wanted freedom and their democratic rights because they complained, it is a travesty.
Okay, could I ask a question that is coming online? Professor Dimitris Sotiropoulos. A question for Nikos and Yorgos. You marvelously managed during the uprising to overcome divisions among student groups and forge unity. Nowadays, unfortunately, the commemorations of the uprising, particularly during the annual rally in Athens, are deflected to violent political activism by very small, marginal political groups. Is there a hope and a strategy to rescue the commemoration of the uprising from such groups?
No, it's it's part of the ecosystem. They've been in the ecosystem in many places in Europe and throughout the world. Sometimes good ideas come out of unlikely places. I am against this type of violence. I'm against the chaos and dirtiness and et cetera, in Greek universities. I say that, and Kevin, I hope you remember it for a long time, that we have to have more discipline in Greece. You know, we have to accept that as part of the ecosystem. And I think that the police and the state could have a little better management on that. I think events are exaggerated or provoked to just discredit the mainstream.
Okay. Nico, can I bring you in on this question?
In a few words, I think that this situation is a disgrace, both for Greek universities, university staff, and the Polytechnic uprising as well. I think actually it is a very well organized defamation technique, because the methods which are used by the marginalized groups, anarchists, and other troublemakers, are in complete antithesis of the ethics which prevailed in the Polytechnic uprising. I think that we avoided violence completely during the junta, and there is no place for violence in the democratic era. I think that myself has very frequently opposed this violence, and when I was rector, I remember that I didn't dare to tolerate such things, but actually I invited the police to clean up the situation. So I think that there must be no tolerance at all against this disgraceful behavior in the universities, because it's not in pursuit of freedom, but it is a pursuit of destroying university liberties and the rights, especially of the poorer, of the poorest people and students, to acquire a level of education which is going to be essential in their lives and careers. I think there is a malign alliance between a group of professors who have actually collaborated with junta, who were very, very, very prompt to tolerate violence by troublemakers a few years after the democratization process started in Greece.
Okay.
In exchange of their somehow acquisition, acquittal from their collaboration with junta.
Okay.
But I think that this style, this environment which prevailed in universities should be strongly condemned.
Yeah.
First by us, who took part in the Polytechnic uprising, but also by every student and every professor.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, the
okay.
future of universities is going to be undermined.
Okay, thanks, Nico.
And this is
okay.
going to be detrimental, above all, to the people who want to make them benefit from higher education.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Nico. There is another question specifically for you, if I may. This is from Professor Dimitris Papadimitriou. I think this is the first time I've ever heard you speak about the Polytechnic events. Why, over the course of your life in politics, have you apparently found it so difficult to speak about the events of 1973 in public? You're on mute. Seems to be adding to the question. You're on mute.
Two things I have to say to my friend, the Minister of Agriculture. First of all, I hope that I have not spent most of my time in politics, but in academics. So it was only about a third of my life in politics. Second, that I have frequently spoken about that in Greece and also abroad. I have given speeches in France, Italy, and also in UK sometimes. Here at LSE, I remember when I was a student in Cambridge University, I was also invited in some other cities in the UK, but I was never invited in Manchester to give a presentation on that.
Okay,
so,
thanks.
In case that Dimitris is willing to do that, I promise that I will positively respond to that.
That would be very courageous of you, given the weather in Manchester. Let's take some questions from here. Manoli at the very back, but if you could just
thank you.
Identify yourself.
Manolis Galenianos at the University of London. This is a question, I think, mostly for Nikos Christodoulakis. So you mentioned that you did not receive any support from politicians, so pre-junta politicians. I was wondering, did you want their support? Did you try to elicit their support, or did you reject them? Did you not care to have their support?
Okay. Thank you. I think that this is a very, very crucial, very tricky question. Thank you very much for saying that. First of all, we offered some type of support by some politicians. For example, by Mr. Kanellopoulos, who was the last Prime Minister of Greece before John Deere, but it was actually not accepted. And also, we had an offer by Constantine Karamanlis at that time to speak from our radio session, but also that was turned down. There was a big fight in the coordinating committee whether we shall appeal to the three-figure politicians, Karamanlis, Mavros and Iliou, representing the Conservative Party, the Centre Party and the left-wing party, in order to support our uprising and take initiatives. But after a very, very bitter discussion in the committee, that was also rejected. We thought that if they wanted to support us, they could do it by themselves without us to appeal to them. And then I think that this turned out to be an advantage because we could claim later on, and that became clear to everybody, that our uprising did not have any partisan motivation or any partisan participation. I think that the strangest of all things was the lack of support by the communist parties, both communist parties. Perhaps they were too much afraid that something would happen against them. After a number of years, I thought a lot about that. Perhaps there were such a short period after the Civil War, after only 24 years have passed since the end of the Civil War, during which the Communist Party was heavily defeated, and perhaps they were feeling that a new period of discomfort and chase and pogroms may follow. So, okay. So they choose to stay away, but also they condemned that one, especially the pro-Soviet Communist Party condemned that as a provocative action. And that, I think, was an unforgivable political error. Of course, a few months later, they changed course because they saw the vast adoption of the uprising by people and by public opinion, who was very moved as they saw defenseless students coming out to protest against the junta, and actually they liked that. But anyway,
okay.
At that time, I don't think that the political support by mainstream political parties would have made any change to the immediate impact of the uprising.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Nico. Thanks.
That actually helped us to keep our identity more clear And I think that this convinced more people to espouse our ideas.
Yeah.
And
okay, thanks. We could simply note that the Communist Party in France did not support the protests in May 1968, for example. Anyway, Vasily. Oh, I think there's a separate microphone.
Thank you. A bit of open question for the panel. I think you all seem to agree with the idea that, you know, the narrative of Politecnio is losing its relevance. So we need to kind of move on. I think there was also the suggestion that, you know, 50 years on, we're entering a different era where Politecnio is not relevant anymore. And I want to provocatively ask, do you think this is because the objective institutional, you know, the problems that the Politecnio that you fought against, demonstrated on, are not there anymore? So obviously we don't have a military government, maybe we don't have police brutality, we don't have American interventionism, and so forth. Or is it that the mindset and the aspirations of the people, so if you want, the individual objective conditions have changed, and they're not, so these demands are not popular anymore. So to use the very nice reference that Zinovia had, is it that Marx became irrelevant, or that Coca-Cola won?
Well,
thank you. There is this phrase describing, you know, the role of historical memories, and says that we have hot and cold historical memories. So when crucial events like Politecnio becomes a sort of cold memory, it's a good thing. It's a good thing that we don't have a recent dictatorship or such an experience to relate to. On the other hand, I would say that the Politecnio memory is still very much alive. I mean, I sit with my students, it's really amazing how it captures their political imagination, of course, in very different terms than the previous generations, but it is a very important narrative to them. And they build their identity, they build their political presence, their sense of debate around that myth. And I think that is very important, and you don't have that with other historical events. So I don't see it losing its importance. And it's also very impressive that now with the 50-year anniversary, we had a series of publications, very good publications, bringing new elements to light. And this is also very relieving. And I agree with a remark made by Yasonas Chandrinos, and he said there is still a lot that we do not know about the events of Politecnia, and there is still a lot to research.
Okay, thanks. Well, I think that's a very good point to close on, if forgive me. However, we're very pleased to invite you to a wine reception outside, and I'm sure George and Zinovia would be happy to continue the discussion. Unfortunately, Nico, we cannot invite you to the wine reception next door, but we're very, very pleased you've been able to join us. And can I ask the audience to please thank each of our speakers.